Hey, welcome to Escape from Plan A. This is Teen, and got a special episode. Jess is in the house. What's up, Jess?
Nothing much.
It's been good to have you back on the wagon.
Yeah. Having opinions again. It's a fun feeling.
Yeah. And then returning guest John Pang. What's going on, John? How's it going?
Hi. Good. Thank you. Yeah. I'm enjoying my time. Yeah.
Last time we got together was a doozy. Yeah. We talked about Sheehan, which I heard is now the correct, that is the correct term. Jess had it right all along. It actually
was Sheehan.
Confirmed by Sheehan's social media account.
Oh.
He said it. We're actually called Sheehan.
Oh.
Okay. Wow. So the title The Shining no longer works. unfortunately. But I thought we got deep into a good topic. And this one, I had another. So John and I actually met up in upstate New York, not far from where when you came to New York, where we were hanging out. And we all stayed in that cabin in the woods over in upstate. And we got on this conversation that I thought was really intriguing to me, John. And I've been kind of thinking about it ever since.
Right.
Which is this sort of, well, it's kind of hard to set the topic up very succinctly. So maybe that's what the pod is about, even just kind of getting the idea out. But was this talk about biculturalism? And John, I've found that your background, your personal background, to be a very interesting contrast to diaspora Asian American, because you've been in America for not just once, but many times and for extended periods of time. But you're Chinese diaspora Malaysian, right? Which I think is very interesting, because it's also an Anglophone diaspora.
It is.
But it's very different, because you're still in Asia, right?
Yes, very much so. And in a region, a cultural, commercial, a trade region, very much linked to China, I'd say, yeah.
And on the other hand, we still share this sort of like Anglo backdrop.
Yes.
To a degree. Yes. I mean, much more attenuated, obviously, in Malaysia versus in America I'd say. But there's still a little bit of that, you know, there's still English itself, and then there's still a sort of, I don't know. I haven't been to Malaysia, so maybe you tell me where I'm going with this, but the extent to which Anglo culture still forms or exerts a kind of influence there. I don't know.
Well, I love the way you set this up. And in the Malaysian case, it's Anglo in the specific sense, as in the UK. And it's that colonial experience, right? As opposed to sort of American. But of course, we live in a world which is in which the influence is very much sort of American now. And as you say, I've spent two extended periods here, you know, one in the from the late 1990s to early 2000s, and more recently from 2016 till now.
And a good spread of places, it seems, not just one place. You've been in California. You've been in, was it Boston, I think, was it? Or
Baltimore, actually.
Oh, Baltimore, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So Maryland, your area, more like, you know, where near where you grew up.
Not too far.
Maryland. Well, I lived in Maryland at one point, and then Baltimore, but quite a bit of time in California. So grad school was in California. And then I went back and I worked, and I returned here, as I said, very late 2016, and have been here on the East Coast in New York since. But that experience, I think, you know, this even the notion of diaspora and of, you know, you set it up in notes and in conversation earlier in very interesting ways. And about sort of being in between and liminality. And these are not necessarily notions or concepts or lenses through which I've viewed myself, or I would say Malaysian Chinese have viewed themselves. But it's really interesting to set them up side by side.
Yeah, and yeah. Jess, I had gone on sort of a rant in the group chat about this, and you kind of picked. I tagged you in it, and I said, you know, I think you and I should talk about this because I find it very interesting. And the point, look, to set this up in a very simple way, I think my point here is if you look at Asian American, like Asian people in America, Asian diaspora living in America, if you look at our cultural works and you look at the sort of emergent culture that's called Asian American culture, which we have been quite critical of on this pod, and I'm starting to understand more why, I think, is that a lot of it exists, what John referred to as the liminality, this idea that we're living in a liminal space, an in-between zone, caught between two worlds view of, you know, our sort of home Asian culture and American culture itself. We're sort of halfway, not totally one, but not totally the other, et cetera. It sets up a certain, I think that it sets up all sorts of assumptions about how culture actually works.
Yes.
And I think part of it, and John and I, you were talking about, this is the part that our conversation I was thinking about when we were chatting upstate, was when you're, I would say, bicultural, meaning, you know, relatively fluent in two different cultures, not just the language, but also just the way that, you know, people in these two different cultures, the assumptions that they have, the way they relate to each other, the way, you know, social hierarchies and statuses are navigated, all that stuff. That you can't, it's not really easy or possible, I would say, to map everything that's in, say, Chinese culture or Korean culture onto something equivalent in American culture. That's, I think, the fundamental fallacy that I've noticed that I believed in myself for a long time until later, especially as I became more fluent in both cultures, to realize, like, there isn't, and there are things that exist in Chinese culture that simply don't seem to have an equivalent in America. And
give
so,
us an example.
That's a hard one. It's so,
yeah, I know. I know it's intentionally hard, but I think like it's kind of critical to be able to nail down specifics for what we're talking. We're talking about a really kind of like theoretical space here. So let's try to ground this.
The reason it's hard is because I can't map it. So I don't know how to explain. Like, I can't really, it's not easy for me to break this down into, like, you know, an English concept, right? But like, one example would be the way that, a very simple example, okay, is the thinking, the sort of like thinking and the social motivations behind who treats for a particular dinner when it's a group dinner or like a dinner with friends, like the how to, like, what motivates people to try and grab that check. I think a lot of the things that go into that and the way that grabbing checks can create social debts, can sort of, is a sort of the signal to the other person that there's going to be another dinner in which you can pick, you know, all that stuff. It just doesn't map onto anything in American culture. Like, it's not, you know, there's no example of that. That's a very simple example. I mean, I think, but does that make sense? Like, it just doesn't seem to work, you know, within American culture. Like, it's not, I can't point to.
I have some. There are some examples that have. We've sometimes, you and I have talked about this in terms of a different ontology, simply in the sense that there are different things in one world that really don't exist. In the other, you can translate it. For example, kinship terms. We have different terms for relatives on the father's side and relatives on the mother's side, right? Mm-hmm. Your maternal grandfather is called something, and your paternal grandfather in Mandarin is your ye ye, and your maternal grandfather is your wai gong. These, but so if I translate it into English like that, So it seems as if I have translated it, but I may not. I haven't translated all that is implied, all that is of import in that set of relations. If I say, for example, ancestor, So it means one thing in Western language or in English, and especially today in modern times, it sounds rather remote. it sounds like I'm doing some sort of mythology or I'm LARPing something to speak of ancestors. But if you're me, for example, this is something real. You know, my ancestors, my genealogy, and who is who in that in that ancestry? These are very real things. We have, you know, ancestral shrines. They are recorded in a certain way in the book, and I have obligations, or I feel a sense of obligations towards. I have a relationship that wouldn't exist, that I can't quite transmit. But if I talk about it, it sounds like I'm exoticizing myself. In those terms. So those are very real. Those are very, very concrete types of thing that exist in one place and not another. And I think what's difficult to translate or doesn't quite translate across is those relationships. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I distinctly remember as a kid, I used to go to this Sunday Chinese language school. Uh-huh. And we had this teacher come from Taiwan. He was very new to the country. And he taught us in a way that as an American kid, I just didn't understand what was going on. And I remember I was very young. I forgot how old, maybe like, I don't know, third, fourth grade. And he goes up to the chalkboard. He writes characters in Chinese, and I forget what they were. And then he writes the English translation, and it was filial piety.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And in fourth grade, yeah. Those did not register to me as real words. I was like, filial, are those made up words? Yep. Is this like a pinyin thing? Like, what? Who knows filial piety? And he was trying to explain the concept, saying this is a very central concept in Chinese culture and stuff. And it just didn't work. Like, there was just as in English, I just couldn't grasp what he was talking about.
There's one that's quite powerful, and we were kidding about it, but this concept of being human.
Nichuoren,
Nichuoren. Whether, you know, I would have heard it in Hakka and in Hokkien, but exactly the same words, actually.
Yes.
And it means something that is difficult to translate.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned filial piety, because in Korean school, we had the same problem. Like, as soon as we got to, like, that word, it's like everything kind of came to a screeching halt. Because now it's not just the word in Korean. It's just, what the hell does that even mean in English?
Which was
our primary language. So it's like we had to, like, translate across, like, two different languages. It was like like moving in 4D. Through this, the vector of this one phrase here. So I distinctly remember that day, like people were getting mad.
And I think stepping through those kinds of breaches is what may risk, you know, orientalization, where we say things like ancestor worship.
Yeah. Good God.
You know, which is like, okay, that sounds like pagan rituals, right? Like, that's not, there's something lost there that in the term, it's too anthropological in a way.
Yep.
And so it's an objective term, but can we understand it subjectively? I mean, we could describe the behaviors, we could describe the specific obligations that we have to visit, you know, our where our grandparents' remains are, etc.
Yep.
But there isn't, you know, being bicultural, I think there's a subjective experience of that.
Yes.
That I just don't find exists in America.
Not only is it, it's very interesting that you call it anthropological. It's not only anthropological; it's Christian and Western in its conception of religion. So there you have these ancestors. You have this practice, and you call it worship, and you put it in this category religion, which is also a category from outside. So, I mean, this is a problem that, you know, the Jesuits had when they went to China in the 17th century, how to categorize this and how to think about it, because thinking about it one way, this is absolutely sort of incompatible with Christianity. Then in another way, no, or they would say, to reconcile themselves to it and to permit it, so to speak, among their converts, the Jesuits said, well, this is ancestor veneration, you know. So this is culture. But the very distinction between culture, religion, we have to be careful of that because we don't experience it. I would maintain we to the extent that we inhabit our own skin in a way, we don't experience it as Chinese people or Asian people. We don't experience it like that.
Yeah. I agree.
And I think I think maybe one of the fundamental issues here is a particular, and I won't even say Western. I think this is a peculiarly American phenomenon. Yep. Treating culture as a distinct phenomenon.
Absolutely.
That can be divorced from things like history, geography. Right. It can even be distinct from the people. That's an interesting thing about the American conception of culture. It can be culture can be divorced from people.
Yes.
It can exist as its own, almost as its own entity in and of itself. And I think that's a perception that no one else on earth has.
Alienable, like fungible, transferable.
Mm-hmm. It IP. It operates like a currency.
It operates as intellectual property. You're right. Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the things that I'm not criticizing necessarily people who have lobbed this complaint, cultural appropriation, right? The entire discourse around it, some part of it was always a little strange to me because it hinged around this idea of culture as kind of as an object that's passed around. That's not to justify, taking elements of people's actual culture and practices, living practices, and then completely desecrating them. But it did emphasize to me just how unique Americans are and in feeling completely in a deep kind of a peculiarly American form of alienation of its people.
Yep.
So when you talk about like ancestor veneration or worship or anything, we're talking about a practice, but I think one of the problems when you try to translate that and convey that to an American, is that it seems like it's a distinct thing.
Yep.
When in reality, it's, again, you have to pull this back into 4D. It's talking about people, it's not just a one-on-one relationship between an individual who necessarily practices this and their, immediate genealogy. It's a respect for their position in this 4D space that they occupy, right? The geography that they occupy, the language, the country that they are in, their social relations. It's a deep respect for how intricate and interconnected we all truly are. And it's just a uniquely Western. And I think America is just at the extreme edge of this, where the industrialization of the 20th century kind of uprooted all of that in the American consciousness. To such an extent that we can actually see these things as distinct elements from each other and not a cohesive whole. So it's very easy for that mind to look at them and be like, oh, these peculiar people who are so chained to their history, and I think it was in vogue to look down on that and say, these are not advanced people. The truly enlightened, actualized people are the ones who are able to separate themselves from that.
Liberate themselves.
Liberate. Yes. And I think that's a Western liberal, a uniquely liberal conception that we have basically achieved a kind of utopia here on earth. Everything that has come before that, insofar it has value, it only has value in leading up to this utopia we enjoy today. Anything that doesn't serve it has to be shed.
That's a very, very eloquent description of this. And I agree entirely. This really hits deep and far back. You're describing a form of modernity. You're describing a kind of, and it's not just modernity in a vague sense. It's Anglo-Protestant as well. And it's the means through which people like others are racialized and particularized, while it occupies for itself a kind of a center, an unmarked universal center. It provides the person who imagines herself inhabiting this a view from nowhere. You know, the subjectivity here is a kind of view from nowhere, and you are the particular. So you have this thing called history or culture and so on, and these are things that I can take apart. There is some you, there's some, you know, one day you will realize that is separate from all this, or can be liberated in some
this,
way.
This, no, I think this is often mm-hmm. referred to yeah. as your authentic yeah. self or something.
Yes, like that, yes, you know. Your authentic self.
The true and this human is underneath exactly. all this cultural baggage.
Right, right. You
know. Which is yeah. very, like the ultimate in alienation.
Very, very alienating. If you I mean, believe
it's you're presented, if, yeah, if you actually accept that ideology, you are aiming, you are trying hard to become the loneliest person on earth. You're basically exactly. saying every influence that I've ever had in my life, parental, social, you know, cultural, you know, the influences from the time and place that I occupy, all of that is actually a corrupting force. There has to be exactly. something pure, a pearl of pure essence, ineffable essence that's functionally unknowable. So distinct, it's unknowable to anybody else, and your life's work is then to shed all of that and just tap into that pure essence, that
the
pure
like authentic, right?
And I think yeah, pure I think
will, a pure will,
pure will, and I think yeah. and unbounded, mm-hmm. and I think that unbounded. There is mm-hmm. what Jess is saying is absolutely right. I think that there is this inference that we deeply buy into in America. That, you know, culture in the traditional sense, which I think is something that we're actually waging war on, both sort of metaphorically and also literally, I would say, quite literally, is that culture is an inherently sort of traditional culture is an inherently sort of arbitrary thing.
Yeah.
That is done without reason. And all of it is meant to subjugate and dim the sort of, you know, unbounded self, this Enrondian sense of self, unbounded self and potential. And traditional culture is merely a prison, an arbitrary prison that has no justification, that keeps the soul bounded. And I think this is just an extremely attractive notion.
Yeah.
When you're seeing the sort of rocket ship of progress, technological progress that we've seen, probably unprecedented implied. In the universe,
yes.
you know, maybe, you know.
Well, we can get into how it slowed down or mm-hmm. what happens when it sort of
when it slows
stops
down, yeah.
and stagnates here in the place where it's, which is supposed to be, it's, you know, the acme of this process of this
yeah,
historical
process.
Yeah,
we're supposed to be in the apotheosis yeah. of that
yes.
industrialization.
Exactly.
And we're finding out that, no, we actually created our own version of hell. And it's not actually entirely clear how we're going to dig ourselves
right.
out, if
right.
we even can.
Right. I threw the baby out with the bathwater, it seems, huh?
There was this
yeah.
project of a kind of culture, or this notion of actually of aculturalism. This critique of culture Teen was talking about, or this... It often comes through the language of freedom. So
yes.
yeah, we have freedom.
That's how it's
sold. You have culture. You have culture. You have history. You're bogged down in history and so on. And we have freedom. And it turns out that freedom is that what we see today is a particular form of culture itself, and it's fairly in many ways degenerate. Or that this. But in the end, I want to say that this whole category of culture we need to think about or you know, poke at with a stick and not take for granted. For example, it, as you say, it divorces us from history. It presumes to divorce us from history, but also from ways of making a living. So does your culture have anything to do with your attitudes towards money, for example, or your or wealth or material goods, you know, how you provide for your children, those types of things. It's as if you could remove that from culture. And very importantly, from allegiances or relationships with certain people in certain places.
Or the having of
some notion of sovereignty. And here you...
Absolutely.
You
end it,
exactly.
Yeah.
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the way I thought about it, and, you know... This is just off the cuff stuff. So, you know, this probably sounds kind of, I find the discussion about culture here in America, and I can't really say I'm tapped into the conversation going on elsewhere either. I just have this to go on, but something feels very, very incomplete to me in that nobody discusses culture from the framework of analyzing what culture does. Right. There's a lot of conversation about what culture is or how to practice it or how to preserve it or something like that. There's not actually a lot of serious thought given to what culture actually does. And I think that's actually central to what culture is actually. Mm-hmm. And this might be for me, this closed the gap in wondering why it felt so empty for me.
Right.
Like to me, to answer some questions about what I see in it, Americans doing actually. So what I mean by that is that to me, the definition of culture, I don't know if any philosopher or theorist or social scientist that supports this or not, I don't really care. But for me, if a working definition of a culture is a time-tested set of practices that a group of people, and this is always in the plural, you cannot develop a culture by yourself, right? A group, a time-tested set of practices, beliefs, values, that a group of people have used to survive in their circumstances.
Right.
It has to be time tested and has to be pro human. Like if it doesn't serve the needs of these people, that culture will die. And chances are that means that the people will die. So I think a culture has to have that authenticity and legitimacy that only time and the tests that just naturally come to people through the course of time can provide. So I think part of the problem here is like when we talk, like especially as, you know, as racialized people talk about culture, we talk about it very, very, in a very, very kind of, I don't know, hollow way. We talk like the specific foods that people eat, right? Maybe special holidays, maybe a little bit of lip service to like, you know, oh, this is traditionally harvest time. And this is when the rice is, it comes in, or this is when the wheat comes in. And this is, you know, typically when we celebrate this, or, you know, the moon, the lunar holidays or something. Not a lot of people really spend a lot of time talking about culture as a collective practice that nurtures collectives as a whole.
Like, I think
for me, like culture to me is like, if I believe this X, Y, and Z. Nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, this is like my definition of like the way I would practice it is that I see for myself, okay, this belief, this practice, this kind of value, if I hold on to that and actually implement that in my life, I can be relatively sure that something good will come of it. Right.
Here's where I'm trying to go with this is that I don't think it matters how we define culture, right? What I'm saying is that culture.
I think it does, based on the topic that you want to talk about.
No, it does. Well, this is my point. Okay. That and I'm bringing this up, this whole point, this whole thing, because we're all bicultural, right? And I think that being bicultural in America, where your home culture, so to speak, is a traditional culture that is not very, doesn't map well to what we would call American culture, right? I'm bringing this up because there's like it's a complicated thing to be. And I think it can be problematic in terms of, and I think we see this in what we call Asian American culture or in the Asian diaspora. We see a lot of cultural confusion. We see a lot of strange ideas coming out, right? We see a lot of like mental health issues. We see a lot of depression among, I think Asian Americans are actually outliers for depression. Am I wrong? And so I think there's a host of problems with this. And I don't think we can think and necessarily map our way out of this by defining culture or coming to an understanding of what's going on. What I'm trying to say is when you're a bicultural person in the same sense that we're bilingual, let's say, right, is that it's a very subjective thing. Like culture to me, the important thing about it is not how it's defined or how it's objectively classified or described, but it's the subjective experience of it. And you know when you're culturally literate, and you know when you're not. The same way that you know you're literate in a language, or you're fluent in a language, and you know when you're not. And when you're fluent in a language, like, you know how, like, all the things we talk about, whether this is an Indo-European language or, you know, whatever, or what sort of, is it a Romance language? What does it use, this type of grammar or that type? Nobody cares. Like, when you're actually speaking the language, I don't need, you know, a linguistics expert to tell me the specific aspects of the language that I'm currently speaking. It's just a thing that I do. Does that make sense? Like, that, I think that's what I'm trying to get at here, is that I think culture is a very powerful force in the same way that language is. It's well beyond the individual. English is well beyond the individual English speaker. I can't make up my own language as I go along. I mean, individual people may alter the language, may kind of push it in certain directions, but the language as a whole is something that's much larger than any one person. But I think that the problem that I see in a lot of Asian American culture is that we, you know, the people who write about it, and I brought in the email I sent to you, I brought up the sympathizer and native speaker as two examples of this, where the protagonist, you know, is caught between two different cultures in an espionage type plot in the back. So there always seem to be a traitor to one side or the other, and they eventually go crazy because they're sort of not sure which side is the authentic self, which I think is a very telling sort of direction that they took that story in, which is like biculturalism as, you know, a burden. Biculturalism as something that prevents you from having an authentic self. My point being that I just think that there's too much assertion of culture as an individual practice.
Yeah.
And thus this belief that we can sort of tailor culture, meaning like, okay, well, I'm Chinese American, right? Well, see, my culture is like, you know, this sort of hybrid of the two. And I think that's as ridiculous as saying that my language is a hybrid of Chinese and English. Mm-hmm. It's not. I either speak English or I speak Chinese. I can't speak in between the two. And look, I'm not saying that there aren't cultural, there isn't cultural interaction, and there aren't any liminal spaces. There aren't any forms of cultural, you know, hybrid forms. Just as there is, or there are pidgin languages, right, that are sort of the mix of the two. But what I'm saying is, fundamentally at core, I think it would behoove Asian Americans to be a little bit more, and I'm talking to myself really here, a little more humble in terms of like the individual's capacity to affect culture for their own, to tailor it for their own ends. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that part just touched on earlier too, and specifically about this against thinking of culture as this individualized thing or as a matter of choice, and that way lies you know, the wreck. I mean, if you think in those terms, you're in big trouble. It seems to me that those works that you mentioned do precisely that. They accept that as the problematic. Once you've accepted those as your starting terms, you end up with this thing where you're either this or you're that. But the problem is accepting that framing of the cultural problem, which is to say an individualized and modern one, which creates a kind of, assumes a kind of center, a being that's before there's sociality and before culture, there is me and authentic me. So that's that whole complex of issues around being modern and being American. And as a consequence of accepting that, you stand in this place and you find yourself between what you think are two cultures. I like the way in which you set up earlier in conversation when you wrote about this model of this metaphor of liminality, which it's become fashionable.
Quite a buzzword, liminal spaces. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's a buzzword. Oh my God! If you're kind of around academia, as I sometimes am, it's you know, it's the buzz term. It's supposedly, it's like agency, you know, used to be. It sort of describes and dignifies this in-betweenness, right? Our Asians being in between our home culture and mainstream American culture in this place. But I would submit, I mean, that's a metaphor that I would in many ways question and reject. You know, this notion of liminality comes from social anthropology. There's an anthropologist, Arno van Gennep. I think in 1909, he had this work, The Rites of Passage, in which he identified, and that's where the term comes from, you know, looking at myth, at ceremony, at rituals all over the world, and all kinds of ritual, marriage, initiation, coronation, and so forth. He identifies three stages in this. And the first stage is a kind of stage of separation, in which, you know, the person or the group who are to be initiated or to be married or crowned or whatever are separated from the rest. And then there's a stage of transformation. And then at the very end, incorporation back into society in this new form. You'll recognize this tripartite structure. You know, Joseph Campbell had a popular version of this in his notion of the hero. The hero sort of, again, separates himself and then he goes out, right? And then he comes back sort of empowered and a new sort of being. But the liminality is this supposedly transitional space in between. And, you know, in describing where we are, it's really sometimes like, you know, painting lipstick on a pig, actually. Because it's fashionable, I think, because, you know, it seems to dignify where you are, because the liminal space is supposed to be this space. Later, another anthropologist, Victor Turner, talked about it and said, you know, this is the space in which there's tremendous possibility, because you are neither here nor there. You are betwixt and between. So, okay, so these writers catch on to that and say, oh, yeah, you're in between one and another, okay? And in this space...
It's a liberal's dream.
It's a liberal's dream, yeah. No, like, for example, everyone knows about, like, in hazing, for example, you know, before you're accepted into that group, they haze the crap out of you, right? You are in between, they break, you reverse the hierarchy and so on. And you are, you know, this is a space in between. The concept implies within it a stage. You are not, it's not a place to live in. You know, this is not anybody's identity to live in. You are in between one and the other, and there's a definite telos to it. You are going to a certain place. It's to dignify it by saying that this is a very creative space in between, you know, it's liminal. Nowadays, it's used for everything, right? For you know, sort of transgressive gender, for any kind of identity.
Every lonely misunderstood soul is in the liminal space.
Yeah, that's right. Lipstick on a pig. Maybe you're just, you know, fucking alienated. Maybe you're just nothing in between this. Right. But this is not a space you can live in, okay? And yeah. I would really be against thinking and dignifying sort of Asian Americanness as a kind of betweenness.
Yes, that's what I'm getting at. And
no way.
I think just
yeah. I was
trying to point out about why it doesn't matter in terms of how we think about this. I'm saying that because I get super frustrated trying to explain to people who don't have the subjective experience of what we as bicultural people might understand about a traditional culture, but the ability to contrast that. See, I've always thought of biculturalism as being a little bit like binocular vision. You have certain extra sense, like certain perceptive abilities that are beyond someone who's monocultural, I think. And I might be self-aggrandizing there, but I think it's true that, you know, you can see the contrast between these two states of being.
No, I think you're correct. If nothing else, it doesn't give you insight into every way of being, but at least opens you up to the possibility that there are different ways of being.
It does give you a stereoscopic ability to process. Yeah, but I just don't think it works, because I just don't think, and this is something that John and I had we talked about in the Twitter space, Miracle Watcher stuff, where the question was, are Chinese capable of understanding Americans, and corollary, are Americans capable of understanding Chinese? And I will posit that I think Chinese can understand Americans, but Americans cannot understand Chinese.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I just don't think that Americans who aren't literate in Chinese culture, and I'm just saying Chinese because I'm Chinese, but like really any traditional culture, I don't think Americans are able to conceptualize even what it means to live within a traditional culture. Whereas I would say that Chinese and Koreans, for example, two very distinct cultures related, or we could pick even further apart, say Chinese and Russian or Indian and Korean or something, you know, whatever you want.
You can even go European.
Hungarian and Japanese.
I think the peculiarity here is, like, I had never really liked the framework of the high versus low context culture. John, I'm sure you're familiar with that framework. It's a pretty common one out there. Just to summarize for the audience, you know, high culture typically refers to, I believe that's an anthropological term, right, to describe different, you know, kind of the ether of different social organizations, like what forms the glue that binds people across these organizations, social organizations. High context refers to low context culture is probably the easier one to start with there. So typically characterized by people being very needing to speak a lot in very direct terms. Rules have to be explicitly stated. So low context meaning that there is very little shared context between any two individuals in this social grouping. So everything has to be stated upfront very directly. Everything is upfront and on the table, and that forms the expected backbone of communication for people who are in a low context culture. On the flip side of that is the high context culture, and I think a lot of ink has been spilled in America about, say, Japan, without really understanding what they were looking at here. So a high context culture is where a lot of the communication is actually unspoken. Mm-hmm. It's kind of crass or rude or aggressive, like almost violent, to just be stating a lot of these things up front. A lot of it is subtle social rules that everyone is expected to just simply abide by and understand. There's ritual around these interactions, and almost none of that needs to be stated up front.
Right.
Correct me if I probably have some of the details wrong, but in broad strokes, that's basically what it is.
Yeah, and I think that's the Zorin. That's the how to be a, you know, what Chinese would say, how to be a person.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like, no, I've read business guides written in like the 80s and 90s, you know, when everybody was in America was enamored with Japan, and a lot of people were trying to, you know, write guides on how to navigate the business culture, and that, you know, it would always boil down to these rules without really being able to encapsulate what the hell is going on here. Like they're talking about, like, oh, you need this is. These are the times when you need to bow, this, this, and this, and this. And this is how you need to navigate a business dinner. This is how you need to speak to somebody with more seniority. This is how you need to speak to someone with less seniority. So it kind of is what you would expect somebody from a low context culture to write about a high context culture. The difference being with Japan, there was an element of respect to it. So there was a legitimacy automatically granted that we don't quite get it, but we're here to crack it, and we love you anyway for it. But really, you know, there's kind of, and it's the literature treats these kinds of cultures as equivalent. I disagree. For one thing, America.
Sorry, wait. I'm a little lost. The literature treats what as equivalent?
High and low culture, like
meaning
both,
they're just on a spectrum. That kind of just, thing.
They're just different. They're the same. They're equal. They're just how different people, like, you're either high or low culture.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lever you pull in categorizing cultures. One's low. One's
yeah.
High. Okay.
Yeah. But, right. You know, in thinking about it, there's really only one low context culture. That's, you know, that would be like the United States.
The modern liberal culture.
Yeah. The modern liberal. Yeah. There's only one, like the US, Canada, maybe Australia.
Western Europe, you know, to the extent that they follow us.
Yeah, to the extent that they have now, you know,
which come under
the aegis of, you know, basically United States. That's it. Everyone mm-hmm. else comes from a mm-hmm. high context culture. And I would argue that they're not equivalent states. I argue that a low context culture is actually probably an immature, a new or unformed culture. They're not actually cultures. This is just a social grouping of people that happen to be in proximity with one another and have to coexist and do business and live next to each other. This is something a little bit less than what I would consider a fully fleshed out, developed culture. Everyone else in the world comes from, I think cultures evolve into high context. I think that's like you brought up the example of, you know, who fights for the check, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a ritual that's embedded in deep, deep layers of social meaning. I like David. I mean, I'm rereading David Graeber's
book. For some reason, I thought you meant like the Czechoslovakian. Oh, no, the Czech.
Oh, like the dinner Czech.
Yeah, it's a big thing in French culture as well.
Yeah.
I've seen like Middle Easterners. I've seen Persians. You know, I've seen South. This is how everybody does this. Yeah. Just America is the outlier.
That's why I said in the email, I use the term traditional culture. I don't think that's an exact term or anything, you know, but I just think it's more like what came before modern American liberalism. And I think actually, you know, and I said this, I don't really totally buy the idea that America is just too young and it takes millennia to build culture. I don't believe that's true. I don't think culture necessarily has to be ancient and deep. I just think that.
No, it has to survive. That's the thing. It doesn't necessarily have to be ancient. Like, it's not necessarily the time. It's the challenges that come with time.
Right,
if it can survive that, then it'll thrive.
Right, but the problem with America, you know, if it was time, you know, things should be getting better. And I think, in fact,
just be a bad culture. It could just simply have gotten too top heavy before it formed something.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that, well, you see, I think that all traditional culture around the world is under assault right now. You know, I think that technological progress is so disorienting mm-hmm. that it can render all cultures in danger. And I think that happened here first, because I think America really stepped into, you know, the breach of like hypermodernity before.
Well, that's the modernization thesis. All was supposed to wither away in much the same way as it has in the US. We were all supposed to go in that direction.
And that was a utopian idea.
It was supposed to be inevitable.
And utopian, right?
Yeah. Like, and we were supposed to converge on a thing, which was America.
We just got there first. Universe. Like wherever we're supposed to end up as a species, we just happen to get to the moon base first. And then we'll leave the doors open for you when you all get here. Is the utopian idea, I feel.
Right.
And, you know, when you go back to that era, I mean, it is shocking, like, how far in the future America was in, say, the 1960s versus the rest of the world. Like, the things that we were doing, you know, versus the rest of the world. It is shocking, like, how far ahead in the technological timescale we were. But now that's spread around the world, and I think that I think America has had plenty of time to develop culture. And in fact, I think Americans were obsessed with it.
I don't know.
I think Frank Lloyd Wright is a perfect example, and he kicked off, and you could just see it in American architecture, and the way that there was this real passion to define a vernacular type of architecture that was distinctly American. Frank Lloyd Wright called it Usonian, Usonian. This idea that the American public, the middle class, like the big fat middle of America, needed to have a certain character to it. It had to have a certain uniquely American imprimatur on it, and these mid-century and early 20th century architects were obsessed with this notion. I mean, now we don't see this. We don't see star architects trying to define what the middle class American suburban tract home is going to be. But they were doing that with the case study homes and all that. And I don't know if that necessarily proves my point, but I do think that if you look at the cultural priorities of America prior to, I'd say, the 1970s, you know, there was a real sense that that cultural progress was something that America had to care deeply about. And I think people really did care about it. At least some did.
Yeah,
I think
you're right.
If the prosperity had lasted a little longer and were a little bit more evenly distributed, it would have had a chance. But going back to, you know, I don't know if, I mean, it's definitely a visual, like architecture, you know, fashion, you know, the way people dress, eat, those are all hallmarks. And there definitely is a distinct American flavor to all of those things. And I don't question that, you know, talented people were hard at work at building this new American cultural vernacular, and were largely successful. But, you know, this is where, you know, you kind of have to, I at least, tried to think about the separation between like the aesthetics of culture, the trappings of culture, and like the deeper principles it serves. Like the case study homes, you know, the American suburban, the vernacular of the suburban home, right? What was that still serving? It was still serving this relatively new social construct called the nuclear family, which was driven by, you know, the need to uproot traditional labor, mobilize traditional labor and send it out where it needed to go, uproot them from like the traditional, like geographic based limitations of the prior era's labor markets. Right. So the nuclear family, which is a new construct, right? Yeah. So yeah. There were huge propaganda engines built to serve that, to present this as the ideal vision of this is the, like, so the cultural value here is like the value of the nuclear family, a woman and a man. Mm-hmm. Typically the man is the breadwinner, the woman is mm-hmm. the homemaker, there's children, but they live in their own home. They're going to mm-hmm. need that, a very beautiful home. They're going to need their nice cars. So the propaganda engine is there to make that seem like the best social organization, the best way we could possibly live.
It still haunts the American right.
It does.
You know, that notion, they don't temporalize it the way you do so well. But that is the America that you want to make, they want to make great again.
That is the promise. That's basically that's the promise.
It's very 1950s.
Like you follow the rules. You work hard. You keep your head down. You don't take handouts, et cetera, so on and so forth. You get a beautiful, smiling wife and your nice home and your, you know, two new cars in the driveway, happy children. That is the promise. And I think a lot of that, the political anger on that side is to try to claim on that promise. Again, kind of, so it's both ahistorical and a little, and very shallow in its own way, but, you know, at least it's, I will give them credit that they actually have a kind of a vision of a life that, of a promise of a life that they want, that they feel this current social moment is not giving to them. I think they are being deeply misled on who has stolen this dream, et cetera. But, you know, the core of that, I don't have it in me to criticize, you know, the anger at having that promise yanked away from them necessarily.
I like this discussion a lot, because this goes to the heart of what I'm trying to express here, which is very difficult because I feel like there's this, to me, I've always felt this way. There is a hard discontinuity between Americanness and Chineseness. There is not a smooth band of transition from one to the other. And what I've felt for a long time in my life is this, when I was younger, I would say in the 80s and 90s, and maybe even a little bit into the 2000s, having been exposed to life that my cousins were living in Taiwan, which is radically different, right? That I always kind of held out hope that America was developing along the lines of something that would be mappable, though very different, but it would be mappable onto culture, the culture that I found in the way of life that I found in foreign countries. I felt the same way about when I went to Europe that I did about Asia. And there was just a certain quality to life there where the people seemed a lot more integrated into their surroundings. People seemed to know each other, even though they didn't know each other. They talked to each other as if they knew each other, at least from my perspective as an American. Hmm.
That's the magic of that high context culture talking.
Yeah,
see someone else from that culture, and you can kind of preload this preliminary mental model of who that person is. Yeah. You have touchstones in common.
And now I would say that what I'm trying to get at here, because look, underlying all of this to me, in terms of priority, is the notion of like mental stability, because I do think it's a very destabilizing time, especially for people who are trying to. I think if you're just going to like kind of bury your head in the sand, you're kind of safe in a certain way. But if you are paying attention to what's happening, and I think it's a very destabilizing time. And the reason I think it's important is I'm saying that being bicultural is a stabilizing thing. The way that being bilingual is a stabilizing thing. It's a positive. And the way the assumptions that have been made up till now, I think, about this liminality, this caught between two worlds notion, is this idea that we need to be fully hybridized but integrated people. We should not be comfortable with the idea that there's this hard cultural discontinuity in us between our American side and our Asian side. We should be integrated wholes, and I think that's a very poor, like a very damaging assumption. And I think people should be very comfortable having the ability to subjectively code switch between one cultural context, say American, and another, say Korean or, you know, Chinese or whatever. It's good to have that ability. And I don't think I think it's this insistence and this deeply held commitment to the idea that we need to be fully integrated, authentic selves that cannot exist, you know, like this between two worlds. You can't do that. Like, okay, well, then which one is the right one?
Exactly.
Exactly. I think that commitment is very destabilizing now. And, you know, and I spent a lot of my youth thinking about this because I just noticed this weird fucking, this strange suburban American ennui alienation growing up in America. And I knew everyone else felt it. It was in the cultural works. It was in the movies. It was in the books. It was in the way people, it was in the music, everything. And it is something that when I went abroad, I didn't see them people suffering the same thing. And then I was thinking, this is something uniquely American. And you know what I mean? Like that just sort of like lost in the burbs ennui of like the 90s and 2000s. And it's only gotten worse. And it's, God, I think that whatever that was, that seed of alienation that I felt in the 80s and 90s, and I'm, Jess, I'm sure you kind of understand what I'm saying. I think that was a fairly universal feeling back then. In fact, it almost became a culture unto its own right to be an alienated suburban teen, right? That's where
we did a podcast about the movies of 1999 specifically.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So these are, so you know, if they were made in 1999, they were talking about filmmakers and actors who kind of grew up in that post-war suburban boom. So these are the people that actually won the American dream, and they're now spending their adulthoods unpacking that and kind of revealing the hollowness or the lie at the heart of it.
They can square the circle. I think they're still struggling with it. And not only that, I think the conditions have gotten worse for the next generations. I think whatever we felt as a mild sense of dislocation has actually gotten worse to the point where we may not recognize that it's actually the same thing, but much worse. And, you know, I'm seeing...
I mean, take a stand for the ethno-burb. I think that's a diametric opposite. That's where I grew up, you know. I look back on my childhood as a wonderful time, actually, in that sense. And I see the most robust, like, pro-human vibe coming from those communities. On the outside, these are the dreaded suburbs that, you know, polite, well-heeled media will have you sneer at. But for some subsets of people, These are the safest, most vibrant communities to be in.
Perhaps. Perhaps that's the case. But I would say that we still have this problem, right?
We still do.
What I'm getting at is that I think that being bicultural allows us, bicultural people are able to diagnose this problem and be more confident in that diagnosis than I've observed Americans who aren't bicultural have been able to do. I feel like they're, a lot of Americans are sort of like swinging around in the dark, and they know something's wrong. They know something's missing. I think bicultural people have a better understanding of what's missing because we can do like a, some sort of compare, like a contrast analysis, you know, like we can see what's missing more clearly, if that makes sense.
I think so. And I think the signal is out there too. Like, again, going back to like cultural appropriation, like if you go a little bit deeper, then like just be like, why? You know, the typical answer is, oh, you know, these are oblivious white people, you know, full of white privilege. They're just they just think the entire world belongs to them and they can partake of it as they choose. That's probably definitely valid in some cases, but a little bit deeper than that, like, well, then why now? Why is this such a phenomenon now? Like, you really see a lot of like white people who grew up in these suburbs really like deconstructing, you know, like, wow, the food I ate growing up was so terrible. You know, my family is so alienated. There's a real, I feel like they are getting the signal loud and clear. There was something hollow and broken at the core of their very quintessentially white middle-class American existence that just simply is not living up to its promise. It's not living up to what a culture needs to do, which is to provide a person with a toolkit to survive and thrive in their current environment. A lot of people are reaching clumsily, stupidly, and, you know, full and arrogantly a lot of time, not disagreeing with that. But I feel like these are all little signals that a lot of people are feeling the exact same way.
I agree.
Like
with you
revealing just saying that, like, whatever we were, whatever cultural project we were on, like that wasn't the way. That wasn't it. We got to find something else. Like one metric really stands out to me, you know, like when I was growing up, probably teen, and John, you've probably heard this too. You know, a lot of the, like, you would see this on sitcoms a lot, sneering at like an adult who had to, quote, move back home. Right. Like this was a mark of shame. You're supposed to be, you hit adulthood, however you want to define that. And you're supposed to be on your own. You live on your own. You're supposed to be, it's kind of a joke that, you know, you have to, like, the overreaching parent who wants to be involved in their adult child's life. And it's like a theme that the child is resisting that and pushing them away. And this is supposed to be the fully actualized adult. You're supposed to run away from your parents. You're supposed to ditch your family. That's what the pinnacle of what it means to be an adult. To have to admit defeat and, like, God forbid, move back home is the ultimate sign of failure. Failure to thrive or failure to launch. I think there's even a movie called Failure to Launch. That's exactly about that. And then what do we see in the last handful of years? The number of adults, not even just young adults, but adults who move in with family, their parents or siblings or whatever, has skyrocketed in the last handful of years. So, you know, and this is really just, this is how humans have always kind of organized themselves. It's actually an extreme abnormality, probably to sell appliances if you get down to it. It's an extreme abnormality for people to be living alone, or even the structure of the nuclear family. That's a historical aberration.
Right.
Yeah. As is wanting to be close, young families with young kids wanting to be proximately close to their own parents so that they can have access to, like, childcare, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the norm, like,
thinking
trashy rom-coms or, you know, whatever, it seemed like the peak existence would be to be a young adult in, like, New York or LA, and then your parents are in, like, Idaho or something, or Wisconsin or something. that seemed like that's like the pinnacle of existence, to be like literally like separated from your family by thousands
that's
of miles.
Very that's very American. That's very American.
Extremely
the
American.
Geography there plays a role.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
you move away and you're half a continent away from your mm-hmm. parents.
Like it's a joke to have to go back to Wisconsin, or you know you have to move in with your parents or something.
Which, by the way, have you noticed a lot of Hallmark movies actually kind of reverse that? And it's exactly that. It's like a young woman who is you know has a big time career in New York City or something, has to go home for the holidays. And, you know, she has to slow down. It's very frustrating. But then she learns a true Christmas lesson about love and family mm-hmm. in her mm-hmm. hometown. You know, like they're actually kind of doing the reverse of this now. It's very interesting.
Yeah, totally. So those currents have been in. And so, like, to see, like, the number of people, like, moving, just simply cost of living. And I'm pretty sure that their mental health is probably improved because this is a more natural way for humans to live. You're not supposed to be this far away from your people.
I think
so. When it comes to, it's like literally everyone else versus America, everyone else versus the American like appliance industry or something.
Right.
To be able to, if you live alone, you can like I thought about this with my mom, and like we all do live apart. Like I live close by to my mom, but you know, separate. And my brother and my dad are spend most of the time elsewhere. So it's like we have like we're family. We're all related. But across us, we have 4 instant pots. We have 4 air fryers. We have, you know, 8 dryers and washers and what have you. So it's like, it was very profitable
you guys are economic gift givers, miracles.
Right.
We need more of you.
As opposed to if all 4 of us lived under the same roof, you know, then we cut that down by a factor of 4, literally. So this was very profitable for like American consumerism. Probably a big, so when we talk about this big cultural push, I think that's actually laundering a lot of it. I think it was the effect of like pure, like the sheer seduction of American consumerism and the possibility, extravagant consumerism that was enabled by the post-war boom economy.
This is more, you spoke about two types of move. One is a sort of cultural project or culture. You talk about cultural appropriation, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. Adopting culture, taking it on as a project. And then this one, which is about relating to one's parents, actually, or to kin anyway, to family anew. And it seems to me that this second one is less, I mean, it's more difficult, but it's a safer route. It's less paradoxical. I mean this, that you know, this idea of choosing culture is inherently, there's a paradox in it. The liberal idea that you can choose everything, that yourself indeed is something you choose, I think bedevils that project.
Yeah.
You don't, you know, the most important things, some of the most important things about culture, indeed about yourself, are unchosen, and these unchosen obligations have a way of being how you become human. It's through these things that you become human, and so if you've grown up to only privilege or only see and acknowledge those things that you choose, then these are out of the way, and you're kind of doomed to set yourself up with the type of problem that you see in those works that Teen was talking about. Yeah,
absolutely. And the idea that you can be a blank slate and that the human project is to simply, you are born with an empty tray and your job is to, like, you know, your parents might throw an apple on it and a banana and a glass of milk, and then you don't want that. So you just throw all of that out and you pick, you know, something else to put on that tray. That's a lie. That's a fundamental lie. That's not to say that people do have the right to, you know, everyone has one life to live. So, you know, what you do with your time and what you want to choose to spend your effort on, that's absolutely a legitimate project.
Hmm.
But this fiction that, that you are that you're born this pure, uncorrupted, authentic self and all of society has just acted to corrupt it in some way.
Hmm.
That's a very deep fiction that I would like to see more serious thought put to, because that's a fundamental lie. That goes against everything we are as humans. I mean, to be an uninfluenceable, you know, state of being, that's being an animal, actually. And even
it's also being, it's showing
truly instinctual.
I think it's showing a deep fear that Americans have of the outside world, and it's represented in our commodities culture. It's represented in the extreme amount of spending that we put towards physical security, guns.
Yeah.
Like, people are literally buying armored vehicles now. You know, people are spending enormous sums on home security. And this is all about this concept of a man's fiefdom, his home being his little fief.
And it's in our law, right? Castle doctrine.
When we have a child, yeah, exactly. It's in our laws too. And when we have a child, our job is to protect the purity of the child and to keep out outside influences from sort of spoiling or degrading this pure essence of, you know, absolute pure beauty. And the outside world is nothing but a corrupting influence that interferes with the parent's duty to protect the eternal innocence of that child.
Yeah.
And it's a very just inward looking kind of fearful culture. And it also, I think there's a weird degree of, like, I would say it, youth worship you know, where we think that making hard choices is inherently bad and traumatic. We think that our children having to learn cultural norms and abiding by them is a trauma to their sense of agency and, you know, self-determination and purity, frankly. And it's this, the degree to which we've gone down that road is pretty, we've gone pretty far.
We've gone down that road, and there's actually a reactionary element to that force, right? And I see that in, like, the extreme the extremity of, like, identitarianism that
there is, you know,
well-heeled liberal culture has adopted.
It's all there is.
Yeah. Well, there is
identity. We're it.
I think that I don't know if you. I know Jess is familiar with Adam Curtis. I don't. Okay. So, Adam Curtis's take on this, which I am kind of pondering, because I think he might be right, is that once you've taken individualism out of the box, you can't put it back in. Meaning that a lot of that reactionary backlash to the hyper-individualism of modern liberal society is not going to go away, and that we're fundamentally, in the West, libertarians at heart, at bottom, irredeemable libertarians, and that's not going to change anytime soon. And so the answer is not going to be found in these reactionary politics, even though I agree, it's found everywhere now. And some of it is actually quite insightful. You know, some of the worst, I would say cult leaders in these movements can say some deeply insightful things about the problem.
Well, they know how to recruit. They know they would have their finger on exactly the pain points in the society where it's failing people.
I think they even have a good diagnosis of the problem. I just don't think that they have the right cure. I think that
I think that's always it.
Just a sense of you know, culture is not something sort of trivial. It's not an adornment. It's not something on the side. It has to do with your survival as a community, and as a people, which ultimately is connected with your survival as an individual as well. You don't thrive without some collectivity, some community like that. And I think things are where so-called liberal culture is today, it's at a point where it doesn't survive, actually. So, I mean, Tien, you were saying, well, you know, we can't change how they think. They're fundamentally libertarian in a certain way. But they're coming up against such profound contradictions in what they're trying to do, what the project is about, such self-defeating, such self-destructive, you know, from the outside, one can see you know, maybe I'm looking at it from the outside, but such profound self-destruction that something has to give. It can't go on like this. And you know, people are literally dying of it.
Yeah, I think this alienated
culture you're talking about, people are dying of it.
Yeah, and I think the problem with his diagnosis there, or his point there, is he might be talking about
Adam Curtis about this irredeemable
libertarianism. Oh, okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
No, but I'm saying, like, you're saying that it won't survive, and that, you know, I think we're still kind of in that realm of what he was saying, that we're, that liberal culture can't back out of it.
Okay.
And
I think they can't see it.
Well, I think the problem with that diagnosis, with that conclusion, is that he may be referring to, like, individuals. Like, we may not be able to reform ourselves. Like, he's saying, like, I would not, knowing what I know, despite my deep suspicions around liberal culture, I would not want to subsume myself into traditional religion or, you know, whatever. And I think he's right. I think most people, even if they've gotten to understand the critique, would not themselves want to subsume themselves into something remotely like a traditional culture. But that, I think, is just the person. I don't know what that means for future generations. I don't, you know what I mean?
It's just the person. And that's not the right unit of analysis.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's the issue.
Yeah. If the salvation is not going to come from the person, which then means it's going to be political. We have this way of divorcing culture from the political, and thinking of the political divorce from culture, that that again leaves us nowhere. But I don't mean culture wars.
I think maybe what we refer to culture wars is still, you know, these are wars between, like, ideologies, basically. Right.
I'm uninterested
Cultural projects, both interested in dominating the non-believer, so to speak.
Yeah.
So kind of imperialist in their own ways, and using the vehicle of politics to kind of enact this vision.
By the way, I think this might be a good point for us to close out this part of the pod, and then you guys want to continue on and do like a bonus.
Yeah, this is going somewhere good.
I actually, for the bonus part, I actually kind of want to turn this a little back on the original topic of Asian diaspora, because I do think that the sort of like what has often been interpreted as the weakness and the burden of being Asian diaspora in the Western world, which I see all the time, and I see a lot of like red pilled takes, and I see a lot of like just a lot of self-loathing involved in this. I think from a separate, when we view it from the frame of what we're talking about here, it's actually a huge strength. And I think that, like, realizing that for me personally has been fairly life-changing, I'd say, not to overstate it, but you know, maybe we could turn the topic towards that a little bit in the bonus.
Sure. Yeah. Nice teaser. All right, I'm about to name drop Nietzsche.
Oh shit. Okay.
just putting it out there.
Yeah. Just
randomly.
Anyway. Mm-hmm.